Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Happy January from HP. Save up to 65% during the Back to Business sale at HP.com. Live through January 14th. Shop online or work with our U.S.-based SMB sales experts to equip your business with the latest technology to drive speed and growth in 2023. Click on the link below or call 1-800-608-MYHP. Save an extra 17% on most business products by using promo code HPBusiness17. Exclusions apply. Act now.
Formula One. It's the pinnacle of motorsport. It's a sport like no other. And 2007 was a year like no other, with just as much drama off the track as on it.
Disbelief is the only word.
It was like a bomb that exploded within the team.
Would you do anything to win? You probably would.
I'm Pete Tong, and this is Sport's Strangest Crimes, Spygate.
One of the biggest stories in the history of Formula One.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 11th of January, these are our main stories. Russia confirms the fighting to control the city of Soledar in eastern Ukraine is continuing. Uganda says the Ebola epidemic that killed 56 people is over. Israel says Iran has the material to build 4 nuclear bombs. Also in this podcast, Russia plans to send a rocket to the International Space Station after a capsule was damaged. And the workers in Japan getting a huge pay rise.
It's raising wages by as much as 40%, which of course is huge. We all want, don't we? It is basically to match Japanese employees' salaries with the rest of the world.
We start in Ukraine, where overnight Russian forces said they'd captured the eastern town of Soledar. But this morning, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov was unable to confirm if the town is now in Russian hands.
Let's not rush. Let's wait for the official statements. There is a positive dynamic in progress. The success of the military operation will be achieved when we fulfill the goals set by the Supreme Commander for the special military operation. Although tactical successes are also certainly very important, they come at rather a high price.
Our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bachega, told us what we know so far.
It seems that the situation is quite fluid. So we had last night this Wagner group, the head of the Wagner group, which is this mercenary group that has been leading the Russian side in the fight for Soledar, saying that Russian forces were now in control of this town. He mentioned, though, that fighting was still happening in the town centre. This morning, we had a spokesman for the Ukrainian army denying that Russian forces were in control of the town, and he said combat operations were still ongoing. So it seems the fighting's still happening. It's difficult to get a clear picture of who is controlling what. It does seem that the Russians have made some advances there, but it's still unclear which side is controlling this town at the moment after days of brutal battle in this town.
It's in the east of Ukraine. Why is it so important?
I think it's not really important, to be honest. I think what is happening here is that Soledar is just miles from Bakhmut. And I mean, for months we've been talking about the battle for Bakhmut. So if the Russians manage to capture Soledar, A, they would have a base from which they could target Bakhmut. But B, and I think this is the most important point here, is that this would be a symbolic victory for the Russians. You know, for months they've suffered a number of humiliating setbacks. So this would be something that they would take back to Russia in a way and say, well, look, we've achieved something. This is victory for us after so many setbacks in this war. So I think Soledar itself is not really relevant and doesn't have strategic significance. It's a very small town. Much of it has been destroyed now, but it could give the Russians something to celebrate if they manage to capture it.
And how important is the Wagner mercenary group to the Russians?
They have been leading the offensive in that part of the country, especially in Bakhmut, which has been the main focus of Russian forces in the east. And the leader of this group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, is a Putin ally. And in a way, he's positioning himself as the leading force here. He's been very vocal in his criticism of the Russian military. And I think he's been supported by some of those military bloggers who become incredibly influential in this war. And he's sort of positioning himself as being, the ones who can defeat the Ukrainian army and can advance, especially when you look at what's happened with the Russian military in recent months, that they have been unable to make significant gains and they have actually lost territory. So he has been prominent and he's been leading the Russian offensive in that part of the country at significant loss. I mean, thousands of men have died because of these battles that have been happening in that part of the country.
Hugo Bachega in Ukraine. Now to Uganda, where the authorities have declared an end to an Ebola epidemic which claimed the lives of at least 56 people. It follows a 42-day period during which no new positive cases have been discovered. The outbreak in September had been caused by a Sudan strain of the virus for which there is currently no vaccine. Our Uganda correspondent, Patience Atuhari, is in the central region of the country in the village of Kilwani, where the first Ebola cases were discovered. And she told me how the outbreak began.
What happened there is that a 24-year-old man who had been ill for a while and his family had taken him to the local clinics and taken him to the bigger hospital in the district looking for care. He even had an operation at some point on his stomach before he was eventually diagnosed with Ebola. The family where that gentleman came from lost at least 8 people to this outbreak. I have met the old man of the house and he was very, very broken because when the outbreak first began, they had no idea what this disease was. They just kept losing family member after family member.
And we understand at least 56 people have died from this outbreak. How far did it spread?
It spread mostly in clusters. People who had been in contact with those who had been diagnosed to be positive with the Ebola virus, mostly in this district, this village where I am, but also in a neighboring district called Kasanda. Those two districts were at the peak of the outbreak put under quarantine, which has just been lifted. But also cases did pop up in Kampala. In fact, a member of that very family where the outbreak began ended up traveling to Kampala seeking care. And a cluster of cases were also reported in another family across the city. Cases did pop up in the east, in Jinja, and also in the southwest. But those were quite isolated. But this particular area where I am was the epicenter. And the pain of the families here is indescribable.
And this outbreak, we understand, was caused by a Sudan strain of the virus. Now, there's no vaccine for that at the moment, but are they working on it?
The authorities were meant to be working on a vaccine. In fact, the government has received more than 4,000 doses of different vaccine candidates from different sources, which were meant to be administered to people who have potentially been exposed to the virus. But now we are at the end of the outbreak, so there are no new cases. That means no new contacts. So we do not know whether this vaccine trial will go ahead.
And are the authorities expecting other outbreaks then?
This particular outbreak, which began in September, has ended, we understand. In this particular region, there had not been other outbreaks in the past. So what the authorities here have been saying is prepare for the worst. The worst might not happen, but prepare for the worst. And as such, at the peak of the outbreak, several isolation units were set up, several laboratories were set up to say that we need the capacity as a country to be able to handle this if it's ever to happen again.
Patience Atuhari. As we record this podcast, US President Joe Biden has ordered an investigation following a computer outage at the Federal Aviation Authority. The issue grounded domestic and international flights in the US on Wednesday morning. Some flights have now resumed. The White House says they have no evidence that it was a cyber attack. And staying in the U.S., California has been hit by yet another storm as torrential downpours and damaging winds knock out power lines, turning streets into rivers as mudslides cut off highways and entire communities. More than 30 million people in the state have been threatened by severe weather, and 17 people have been killed. James Clayton reports now from the coastal town of Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz is famous for its surf, but not quite like this, as waves batter the coastline. The city has seen a seemingly relentless, never-ending string of storms this winter. Its historic pier has been smashed, beachside houses destroyed.
This is supposed to be a picturesque beach, but it's absolutely covered in detritus, wood, even entire trees that have been swept into the sea by swollen rivers.
A state of emergency has been declared here, and it isn't just the coast that's been hit. Up in the mountains, the small town of Felton has been underwater as the local river burst its banks. Karen Hendrick realised the water was coming up to her house too late. She couldn't get out, stuck above the water as it rose around her home.
Is it scary when you're surrounded by floodwater like that?
This was the first time that I was scared, yeah. In the past, I always thought, you know, oh, we'll get 3, 4, even 5 feet of floodwater come through. This one didn't seem like it was going to stop. And I was imagining, you know, 10, 12 feet of water. So that was pretty scary.
24 hours ago, the floodwater was about up here to my chest. It's now receded, but what it's left is this thick, glutinous mud, which has covered what is, in fact, a paved road. And of course, the mud hasn't just stuck to the streets. It's covered the inside of people's homes, too.
Audrey Baxter is a student who lives in the town. She lost childhood memories.
My art portfolios from when I was younger are all in here.
Can I have a look?
They might be in one of the trash bags, but these were all just like games and books.
Can you show me that?
This is just Silly Sally. And it's just something I used to read as a child, and it's all just soaked all the way through.
Santa Cruz isn't alone. Many other areas across California are being deluged. Floods, landslides, and blackouts. It's left Californian politicians scrambling for resources and worried about what's to come. This is Gavin Newsom, the state's governor.
Have you ever seen anything like it?
Not at the scale. I mean, I've seen isolated incidents. These experiences are unique in that respect. They're novel, but they're also predictable because this is our lived reality with this weather whiplash and the extremes, and it's likely to see more of this in our future.
Each weather system that hits California wouldn't do much damage by itself, but it's the insistent nature of the weather, storm after storm, that's pummeling the state. And with no end in sight, California is braced for yet more rain and more damage to come.
James Clayton. Israeli officials say Iran now has enough enriched uranium to build 4 nuclear bombs. Tehran insists its nuclear program is entirely peaceful, though France, Germany and Britain recently said there was no credible civilian justification for its enrichment program. So, what more do we know? Our security correspondent is Frank Gardner.
The Israelis have been warning for quite some time about Iran's nuclear program, which Iran insists is entirely peaceful. And there's no open source of being able to substantiate the Israeli claim. What we do know is that the E3, that's the governments of the UK, Germany and France, issued a joint statement, two joint statements actually, in November and December, in which they said they were extremely concerned at the level of enrichment Iran is doing, well above the levels permitted in the Iran nuclear deal. And they mentioned that Iran has enriched uranium up to 60%, which is well beyond civil use. Now, it doesn't take much to move from 60% up to 90% plus, which is what you need to build a bomb. The Israelis are not saying in this briefing that we had, they are not saying Iran is building a bomb or that Iran is about to build a bomb, but that they have enriched enough uranium to give them the quantity that, should they choose, they could build 4 nuclear devices, but with a very important caveat that it would still take them nearly 2 years to what's called weaponize that, to turn it into an actual viable device. But the Israelis feel that they are right in the front line for this. So this is probably about the 1,000th time that they've warned of the dangers of Iran's nuclear ambitions. In this particular case, they've put a figure on it.
Frank Gardner. Russia is to send a Soyuz rocket to the International Space Station next month to bring home its three crew members. The original capsule sprang a coolant leak, making it unsafe. Sasha Schlichter reports.
Russia's space agency has confirmed that the December 14th leak was a result of damage to the radiator pipeline from a tiny meteorite. The minuscule hole spiked temperatures inside the capsule to 40 degrees Celsius. All spacewalks were cancelled as ground control focused on the leaky capsule, essentially a lifeboat for the crew. It is now to descend to Earth in unmanned mode. The two Russians and one American will depart the ISS on another Soyuz rocket, which is urgently being sent to the station. Flying uncrewed will allow it to launch weeks before the original mid-March date.
Sasha Schlichter. Now to Japan, where the Japanese clothes retailer Uniqlo has announced it will give its employees a huge pay rise. Our correspondent Marika Oi has the details.
It's raising wages by as much as 40%, which, of course, is huge. We all want, don't we? It is basically to match Japanese employees' salaries with the rest of the world. But secondly, this is a country where companies hardly gave a significant pay rise since the early 90s. And that's something the Japanese prime minister wanted to change. So a week ago, in his New Year address, he's asked businesses to raise wages as the country experiences its first proper inflation in decades. Now, the rate of inflation is still under 4%, but Japan had been tackling falling prices known as deflation. So for Japanese consumers, this is the first time they're experiencing a price hike of daily essentials. And when their salaries don't catch up with it, they've really been hit hard. Now, the boss of fast retailing, Tadashi Yanai, has been very critical of the government's economic policies lately, especially when the value of the yen fell sharply last year, saying that private companies and individuals now need to step up to make sure ordinary consumers are protected from inflation. But he's also known to be somewhat of a trendsetter, if you like. I remember interviewing him back in 2009 when he told me that China was getting too expensive, so he was moving production to Cambodia to cut costs. And this was when the rest of the fashion industry was still moving into China. So the hope is that other Japanese companies will do the same with its pay rise. But even though this latest pay rise will increase the company's cost by 15%, investors seem quite okay with it. Shares actually went up following the announcement, and it's still trading higher by about 1%.
Marika Oi. Coming up in this podcast, we hear about the risks of cold water swimming.
So when any of us have a cold shower or get into cold water, we will feel that cold shock response, that gasp for air, that sense of feeling a little bit breathless. The breathlessness of SIPE is different from that.
A man has attacked several people with a knife in Paris, leaving a member of the French border police seriously injured. It took place in the Gare du Nord train station early this morning. Our Paris correspondent, Lucy Williamson, gave me the details.
Well, the Interior Minister, Gérald Darmanin, has been down to Gare du Nord and has spoken. He said that the suspect had attacked people at the entrance to the station with a knife, some kind of knife or sharp object, and also then attacked some people inside. And he's wounded six people, one of them more seriously than the others. The Interior Minister said the whole attack took 1 minute because off-duty police officers who were at the station on their way home after their shift spotted him and used their service weapons to fire at him three times and stop the attack. So the suspect himself is now injured. He's been taken to hospital, and that's somewhat holding up the inquiry because obviously he's being treated for his injuries first, and then investigators are going to have a chance to try and question him and work out why this attack happened. But the Interior Minister said he did not have any identity documents on him, so that's obviously hampering the investigation at this point.
And the Gare du Nord, I know you've been there many times. It must have been very busy when this happened.
Yeah, I've been there more times than I can count, I tell you. It's the place people leave for Calais. It's the place people leave on the Eurostar. All the trains going north. It's incredibly packed, particularly for the mornings. This happened very early at 6:42, Mr. Darmanin said, in the morning. So it wouldn't have been quite as packed as it would have been perhaps half an hour later. But certainly it's not a quiet place. There's always people milling around, always trains coming and going. It's certainly one of the busiest stations in France.
Lucy Williamson. To Peru now, where the country's attorney general has opened an investigation into the president and leading ministers following weeks of deadly clashes between anti-government protesters and security forces. The charges include genocide and homicide. There's been unrest since the jailing of Peru's left-wing leader Pedro Castillo last month. Speaking in Congress, Prime Minister Alberto Otarola denounced the violence.
Deploro. I deplore this aggression against the forces of law and order, and once again we'll call for order, peace and tranquility for all Peruvians. We cannot be murdering each other.
Dan Collins in Lima has more details.
The Attorney General's probe follows the latest and most lethal bout of violence since the jailing of Peru's left-wing leader Pedro Castillo a month ago, pushing the number of deaths to more than 40. Clashes and looting continue in the city despite a curfew. On Tuesday, Peruvian police announced an investigation into the killing of an injured policeman who, they claim, was burned alive in his car after being attacked by a mob. 3 days of mourning have begun in the southern region of Peru, but protesters continue to call for Ms. Boluarte to resign, Mr. Castillo to be freed, and for fresh elections.
Dan Collins. Thousands of women and children are being held in detention camps since the self-styled IS caliphate was defeated back in 2019. Many come from countries that don't want them back. The British schoolgirl Shamima Begum, who left home back in 2015 to join the Islamic State group in war-torn Syria, is probably the best-known case. Her story has been followed for some time for a BBC podcast called I'm Not a Monster, the Shamima Begum story. And in it, she talks to the host, Josh Baker.
Do you understand why society has so much anger towards you?
Yes, I do understand. But I don't think it's actually towards me. I think it's towards ISIS. But when they think of ISIS, they think of me because I've been put on the media so much.
But they only did that because you chose to go to ISIS.
But what was there to obsess over? We went to ISIS, that was it. It was over. It was over and done with. What more is there to say? Like, they just wanted to continue the story because it was a story. It was the big story.
But you do accept that you did join a terrorist group?
Yes. I did.
This is how Zara, not her real name, described Shamima at school.
She was a ghost. Literally a ghost. Like, I could hear a pin drop louder than her voice. She was very to herself within her own little friendship group. She seemed like she was in her own bubble.
She wasn't a big presence then?
No, not at all, no.
Host Josh Baker has been talking to Misha Hussein.
What she said to me is, look, I accept that I did indeed join a terror group, which is a slightly different tone to what we've heard from Shamima before. So she is, I think, now in a space where she's very much reflecting on some of the actions that she took.
Presumably her aim is to rehabilitate her image and to try and get back to this country.
It's undoubtedly the case that Shamima wants to come back to the UK. You know, she would say, bring me home, I want to have my day in court. You know, her lawyers also argue that she is a victim of grooming and trafficking. However, the British government says that, you know, Shamima is a threat and they took away her citizenship to prevent her from coming home to the UK.
But this admission that she's made to you, that she accepts that by going to join IS, she joined a terror group, what does that open her up to in terms of charges?
Well, it's hard to say what that will do in terms of the case because it's currently in a SIAC hearing, which is an immigration hearing, and the evidence has been heard in that. Now, she's outside the jurisdiction of the UK. When she comes back to the UK, if she comes back to the UK, that could be a time where she faces criminal charges. But at the moment, it probably has very little bearing. I think when you look at Shamima's situation, what's clear is before she left, she was indeed fed detailed instructions by IS members. But at the same time, she did actively seek out IS members online to help her, and she also did things like look up language words in Turkish that she would need to help her with her journey. So she has agency in this, as well as indeed being fed information.
Josh Baker talking to Misha Hussein. The Golden Globes have returned to American television a year after the award show was dropped over a row about racial diversity. The big winners were Steven Spielberg's semi-autobiographical drama The Fablemans and the Irish comedy The Banshees of Inisherin. Our correspondent Peter Bowes sent us this report from Los Angeles.
Welcome to the 80th annual Golden Globe Awards.
For decades, the Golden Globes have kicked off Hollywood's award season with a party-like atmosphere
and a ceremony awash with A-list celebrities. But the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the group behind the show, has been mired in controversy. Allegations over a lack of diversity in the then 87-strong voting body and other ethical lapses led to the Globes being taken off the air last year. A dramatically scaled-down ceremony still went ahead, but it was boycotted by Hollywood's Great and Good. Now the Globes are back to try to nurture a new, inclusive image, starting with the host.
I'm here because I'm black.
The comedian Gerard Carmichael didn't shy away from the controversy, joking as the first black host in the show's history, he was unfireable.
I heard they got 6 new black members, congrats to them, whatever. Sure, but it's not why I'm here. I'm here truly because all of you, I look out into this room and I see a lot of talented people.
And so it was on with the awards, chosen by a larger pool of voters from a more diverse membership.
Mrs. Wang, are you with us?
I am paying attention.
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once was one of the night's big winners. The comedy drama set in the multiverse stars Michelle Yeoh, the Malaysian actress who plays the owner of a laundrette.
This is also for all the shoulders that I stand on, all who came before me, who looks like me, and all who are going on this journey with me forward. So thank you for believing in us. Thank you.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me, I just don't like you no more.
The Banshees of Inisherin, the dark comedy about a fractured relationship between two lifelong friends, was named Best Comedy, and one of its stars, Colin Farrell, Best Actor.
I never expect films to work or to find an audience, and when they do, it's shocking to me, and so I'm so horrified by what's happened around Banshees over the last couple of months, in a thrilling kind of way.
Movies are dreams.
Steven Spielberg's The Fabelmans, the story loosely based on the director's childhood, won the award for Best Drama. It's now a front-runner for the Oscars in March. There was a change of tone when Sean Penn took to the stage. The veteran actor introduced a recorded message from the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky, who addressed the ceremony to rally support for his country and its war against Russia.
It is now 2023. The war in Ukraine is not over yet, but the tide is turning, and it is already clear who will win. There will be no third world war. Ukraine will stop the Russian aggression on our land.
Welcome to the White Lotus.
In the TV categories, the main winners were The White Lotus, Abbott Elementary, and the Game of Thrones spin-off, House of the Dragon.
And all the dragons roared as one.
The organisers of the Golden Globes say they're committed to making more changes to make the awards more diverse. But with just a one-year contract for the ceremony to be aired on TV by the NBC network, the show is still on probation. Its future is far from certain, but Hollywood seems to be in a mood to move on.
Good night.
Peter Bowes reporting from LA. Now, are you one of those people who loves jumping into the sea or a river at this time of year and feels the benefits of cold water swimming? Well, the British Medical Journal says swimmers should be told more about the risks of a lung condition known as SIPE, swimming-induced pulmonary edema. They reported that although this is incredibly rare, a healthy, regular open water swimmer in her 50s suffered from the syndrome during a night swim in a quarry. She's since recovered. Dr. Ruth Williamson is a channel relay and winter swimmer who's investigated the health benefits and risk management of cold water swimming.
SIPE, swimming-induced pulmonary edema, is, if you like, drowning from the inside. What happens is that fluid from inside your own body accumulates in the lungs, in the air spaces in the lungs. And that therefore means that your lungs don't do their normal function, which is putting oxygen into your blood. The symptoms can come on slowly or they can come on quite rapidly. And if you think what's happening is that fluid is coming into the lungs, some people have described feelings of heaviness within the lungs. A lot of swimmers describe the fact that they seem to be putting more and more effort in and not going as fast as they were going before. So the swimming becoming more effortful. I think cold water swimming is definitely an acquired taste, and it's something that needs to be undertaken with caution. And people should acclimatise slowly to open water swimming by gradually increasing the time they spend in the water and learning to understand how their body feels. So when any of us have a cold shower or get into cold water, we will feel that cold shock response, that gasp for air, that sense of feeling a little bit breathless. The breathlessness of SIPE is different from that in that it doesn't settle down. If you think about the RNLI float to survive, they talk about cold shock. And what you should do is lie on your back and just let your breathing regulate. What happens in SIPE is no amount of lying on your back will help your breathing to regulate. You need to get out of the water. And that's why you should never swim alone, because even if you're a really good swimmer, if you suddenly experience SIPE, then you will have what we call swim failure and find yourself unable to swim.
Dr. Ruth Williamson, and I have to say our editor Karen is a big fan of cold water swimming. Well, just before we go, Ollie has popped into the studio with a quick request.
Yes, thanks, Val. Did you know it's nearly 3 years since Britain left the EU? Of course you did. Well, we're doing a special podcast to mark the anniversary of Brexit at the end of the month, and we need help to put it together. We're looking at Britain's place in the world post-Brexit. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on the subject so we can chew them over with our Brexit experts, Rob Watson, Katya Adler and Darshini David. So I want to know, what do you think of global Britain now? Please email us and preferably include a voice note, and Val will give you the email address in just a second. Thank you.
Thanks, Ollie. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Kouzaris and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Seven years ago, I was filming at East London Mosque when the story broke that three schoolgirls from the area had gone missing. They were heading to Syria to join the Islamic State group. Shamima Begum was the only one of the girls to emerge from the ashes of the so-called caliphate. I've retraced her steps to investigate the truth of her story.
What do you think people think of you?
As a danger, as a risk.
The Shamima Begum Story, Series 2 of I'm Not a Monster.
Listen, wherever you get your podcasts.